Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Exactly 50 years ago tomorrow, at just about this time, American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were making their descent toward the surface of the moon. Their colleague, Michael Collins, watching from orbit, and the rest of the world watching on TV. It was an incredible triumph of engineering, a pinnacle of human achievement. And today, we're going to spend the hour celebrating the hard work and creativity that got us there and exploring the lasting legacy of the Apollo program and how it still impacts our lives back on Earth 50 years later. But before we begin our discussion, let's revisit that remarkable journey into the stars.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain?
This is Apollo Saturn Launch Control. We are go for Apollo 11. Firing command coming in now. We're on an automatic sequence as the master computer supervises hundreds of events occurring over these last few minutes.
So the three astronauts are now going through the procedures just described for us in their tiny spacecraft on top of this enormous rocket. They have about 160 cubic feet in there, which is about the size of the interior of a small automobile.
Launch operations manager Paul Donnelly wished the crew on the launch team's behalf good luck and Godspeed.
A giant rocket, more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented.
T-minus 15 seconds, guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start.
And do all this, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first. Before this dictate is out, then we must be bold.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Program. Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
In just 50 minutes from now, well within the hour, the moon is due to have visitors from another planet.
We're still go, altitude 27,000 feet.
Same alarm, and it appears to come up when we have a 1668 up. Roger, copy.
And we're getting a picture on the TV.
Okay. You got a good picture, huh?
There's a great deal of contrast in it, and currently it's upside down on our monitor, but we can make out a fair amount of detail.
200 feet, less than a mile from the moon, sir.
Manual attitude control is good.
Okay, engine stop. ACA at a descent. Mode control, both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off.
We're home.
413 is in.
Man on the moon.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen,
oh, jeez.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
You're looking good here.
What?
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute. After I'm on, take care of the I'll get this button prepared.
Wally, say something. I'm speechless.
I'm just trying to hold on to my breath.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I'm going to step off the land now.
Man's dream and a nation's pledge have now been fulfilled.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The lunar age has begun.
Some way, when those two Americans stepped on the moon, the people of this world were brought closer together. That it is that spirit, the spirit of Apollo, that America can now help to bring to our relations with other nations.
The dawn of this day heralded the dawning of a new age, for with the first steps on the moon, man's strides across the universe really began.
Hi. Here with me in studio is Dava Newman. She's the Impallo Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT and a former Deputy Administrator of NASA. Dava, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, so nice to be here.
And also here with me is Kelly Beatty. He's a space reporter and senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly Beatty, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious my reaction to what we just heard. That was quite a journey. What was yours?
It's emotional every time, and it lifts us up, though. I mean, that's hope. That's anything's possible when we put our mind to it. And I never get tired of it. I can hear it a million more times. I'll never get tired of it.
I probably will listen a million more times by Monday. Kelly, how about you?
Well, you know, it's one of those seminal events in the history of our country. Everyone old enough to remember remembers exactly where they were when the touchdown occurred. And I think what makes it so moving is that it represents, it is a pinnacle. It's the tip of the iceberg of technological achievement and a decade-long drive to complete this objective, on a timetable, to a date certain. And it kind of shows what the United States can do when it puts its mind to it.
One of the things in that opening sound that really hit me the first time I heard it were the reactions from CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite. And the person with him is an astronaut. It's Wally Schirra. And they're watching the landing while broadcasting live. I actually want to hear that little bit of sound again.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
You're looking good here.
What?
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute. After I'm on, take care of the deep end. I'll get this bus prepared.
Wally, say something. I'm speechless.
I'm just trying to hold on to my breath. What?
All right, so my own reaction a minute ago to the contrary, we don't really usually hear broadcasters get choked up. And if we do, and this is what I think is important. If we do, it's usually over a tragedy, not over a moment of such inspiration. So what was it about this moment that it's 50 years later, that makes it so powerful now?
It was, everything was on the line. And in the transcript, you also hear Charlie Duke. He's on Capcom. He's there. He's the one who says, oh, you have a whole bunch of guys going to turn blue here, because they had not been breathing, because as Neil went down, he took over manual control. And so it was not an easy landing. It was, it was human and computer and flying down. And so it was not an easy landing, and everyone just big sigh of relief. Not the people watching. I think it was different for all of us watching those kind of scratchy TVs, and it was an audio, recording. But it was just, we did it. Are you kidding me? We've been, working so hard, but we have achieved this. And to make sure that they were, safe and had landed on another planetary body.
Yeah.
Dangerous. I mean, there's no question. It was a dangerous undertaking. And, there's a side of people that want it to succeed, but wonder, gee, what would happen if they crashed? What would that be like? During that broadcast, 600 million people worldwide, one-fifth of the world's population, were watching.
That's incredible.
And so it was not just a U.S. event. It was a global event.
So I want to listen to some more sound, because I want to talk – you talked about the danger of this, right, and the uncertainty in those moments when he takes over the controls for himself, which I didn't know about that. This is John F. Kennedy, and he's got this incredible list that he gives during his famous speech in Houston in September of 62 about what's going to have to happen, how we're going to have to innovate, and the challenges. Let's listen.
A giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, the length of this football field, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses, several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food, and survival, on an untried mission to an unknown celestial body.
So, Dava, holy cow, because we had to get them home, too. How did we do it?
It's just raised us up. And so that's what, as an engineer, you know, rocket scientist, that's what we love. We love the hard problems. We don't want to solve the same problem and have to have a special shout out to the Guidance Navigation Control. That was MIT's piece. Mm-hmm. That was our instrumentation lab. And Draper, it was a one-page contract. How good is that?
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? The whole contract for Draper to do space?
The only contract for a university went to, you know, MIT Instrumentation Lab, which becomes Draper. And so that's a lesson learned, too. And just, you know, we had to get it right. It was, you know, young engineers working on it day and night. But it was totally unified again, back to teamwork. And you knew you were doing something really special, I imagine, you know, as 5 years. But you just knew. It just was calling out the best. You know, rise up to the challenge, solve the problems, and be creative, innovative, you know, new metals. Everything had to be invented. And the integrated chip, right? It was a huge boom for the computer.
So this is – go ahead, Kelly.
Well, and you raise a good point, which is the Apollo program attracted to NASA the best and the brightest in terms of engineers. This was something that, you know, NASA had only existed for a couple of years as a government agency prior to Kennedy's mandate. And NASA had to ramp up in a big hurry. I think the numbers I saw, they went from 10,000 employees to almost 40,000, plus all the contractors involved. And all of those people were just incredibly driven to be part of this project.
So, Kelly, when I listened to the President Kennedy, what I found myself thinking was, that is an informed list that he's making, which made me think that could not have been the beginning. They must have been thinking about this for a long time to know what that list was, to know what would be required. But you just said NASA was only a couple years old. So either Kelly or Deva, how long in advance of that speech in 1962 were we really already planning for this?
Well, it was a three-phase plan. So it was Mercury and then Gemini and Apollo. And so it really was the combination of the three-phase plan. But the technologies and how to get it done and how to get the big rocket, the Saturn V, those things we really didn't have a clue about. But the list was sharp. The will was there. You know, it was when leadership from President Kennedy. But why does Rice play Texas? Anyhow, you didn't play that.
Right, well, I
memorized it when I was five.
Awesome. I want to get to another point that Kelly just made about that, you know, 40,000 people, this incredible talent. This is Michael Collins, the unsung hero of the landing, in a post-flight press conference in September of 69. He actually stayed up in orbit as the LEM landed on the surface. Let's hear him.
This was a busy time for me in that I was taking these motion pictures through the right-hand window. At the same time, I was taking still photos through the left-hand window and also flying my vehicle and...
Okay, that's not even enough hands to do that, right? So I don't know how he did that, but... He's kind of an emblem. We're going to hear a little bit later from somebody who programmed, one of the thousands of people who did programming for the moon landing. What do we need to understand and appreciate that maybe we don't? And Kelly, I'll turn to you in this. Of the thousands of people who put themselves into this.
So, you know, just to touch on a point you made earlier, Kennedy wasn't particularly enamored of the space program when he took office, but
you can't tell me that. He's like,
I'm sorry, it's true, but he was a cold warrior, and he'd already in very quick succession, you know, he made this announcement just 4 months into his presidency. In very quick succession, he'd endured – Mercury astronauts had been selected, but then Yuri Gagarin made his historic flight for the Soviet Union, first human in space. And very quickly after that, there was the Bay of Pigs fiasco involving Cuba. And so he needed something in a hurry to regain stability, and he had been talking about this, but it was time to act. And so the people who came forward to be part of this – a friend of mine named Andy Chaikin, who wrote at the time the seminal book on the Apollo program, A Man on the Moon, is now working to understand Apollo systems and NASA systems. How do you design a project of this scope, let alone how do you find the new alloys and build the rockets? Just how do you manage the process? And it's a study in success, with a few bumps along the way.
So, go ahead, David.
And so just to add to that, leadership matters. But President Kennedy obviously didn't have the technical background, but he had great people with him. So the leadership for Apollo and how we got there and how we got there so fast, and the moon was the right target, that's for sure. There is Administrator Webb, First Administrator, and Bob Siemens, shout out MIT professor, and he was the deputy administrator during the time of Apollo. So you had great technical engineering expertise in the deputy. You had a great political leadership. And so they were really advising President Kennedy to get this all right.
So, David, you talked about leadership. It strikes me that there's also something about the appetite for risk. Here's what current NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said just last Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation.
So the way I talk about this, there's two risks. There's technical risk, and then there's political risk. We would be on the moon right now if it weren't for the political risk. We would be on Mars, quite frankly, by now, had it not been for the political risk.
So first, do you agree?
Well, there's lots of risk. I agree in that, during Apollo, they took a lot of risks. They also had a very big budget. So I don't actually divide risk into that. But you have to have the will. You have to have the vision, the leadership, and you have to have the will of the people. So the technology we still are working on, but yes, we sure can accelerate things. We need the innovation and we need to, everyone moving in the same direction. And then there is the political, not risk, there's just those people, right?
Yeah.
These are complex systems.
Yeah.
Apollo is a complex system, but guess what? People are really complex as well. So you have to understand it.
That is true.
I think I'm going to take a contrarian view.
Okay, go for it.
I think that by the time that the Apollo program was winding down, the American public had kind of same old, same old. The last two Apollo missions that were planned, all the equipment was built. The crews had been selected. They were canceled. They took the last Saturn V that was going to fly a mission. They used it to launch Skylab. This was during the Nixon administration. By that point, we were looking ahead to a new program that could take us beyond the moon. That fell to the National Space Council, headed by Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president, and his first one. And they came back with a plan to go to Mars with crews. And to get there, they needed a stepwise approach. And the workhorse for that was going to be the space shuttle. And what all we got out of that was the space shuttle. We never got to Mars. And I don't think that after Apollo, there was the political will to do it again.
So, David, let me turn to you with just one last question. And based on what Kelly just said, in your mind, what is the ultimate lasting legacy of Apollo 11?
It's really the Apollo generation. It's the impact that it had first globally. It wasn't just for the U.S. It was for humanity. We came in peace. That's what the plaque says. So, we just got it right. It was global. It was humanity. And we were at our best. We were at our best. And we were all in this together.
That is David Newman, the Apollo Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT and a former Deputy Administrator of NASA. David Newman, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy Apollo 50.
Yay, you too. Thank you. And it is happy. And Kelly Beatty, space reporter and senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly Beatty, thanks to you as well.
Okay, my pleasure.
You are listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. We know the Apollo 11 mission carried three men into space, two of whom actually stepped onto the moon. But the mission, it involves so many more men and women working hard to get them there and get them home again. We spoke to one of those who worked behind the scenes, Don Iles. He's a software engineer, and he literally wrote the code for the descent and landing programs for the lunar module. He told us about all of the variables and challenges that the team faced in making the moon landing happen.
What you have to do to land on the moon is you have to start in a lunar orbit, which means you're going about 3,800 miles per hour around the moon, and you need to bring the lunar module to a stop right side up at a particular place on the moon. It's a difficult problem because you don't have to just reach a point. You have to reach a point under certain conditions. And another factor was that we needed to rely on the human eye of the astronaut to be able to land specifically where we wanted to, and therefore the trajectory had to be set up in such a way that the astronaut had visibility of the lunar surface in front of them. We also had to operate the lunar module's engine, a very interesting and at that time unprecedented throttleable rocket, We had to operate that engine within some constraints established by the engine manufacturer. And we also had to mold the trajectory in such a way that a radar called the landing radar could sense the surface and measure the altitude and the speed across the surface, because without that local check, it wasn't safe to land on the moon based purely on your inertial navigation. So all those things came into play during the lunar landing.
In working with coding for the lunar module, did you find you needed to have a very strong grasp of physics or other branches of science as well in order to be able to be effective in your work?
I wouldn't say so. Writing the code was a much more almost literary or almost artistic sort of an effort, where we were building something. It was like sculpture. It was like making sculpture, except it wasn't chipping stone. It was a matter of molding clay, because there was a sort of trial and error during the cycle of development, where you would try to do something and you would test, and then you would, based on those tests, you would learn to do it better. So it was more of a construction job, I would say, than a pure science job.
I love this metaphor of art and sculpture. Given that this was trial and error work, were you ever nervous about your work? Not that you didn't know what you were doing, but this is a high-stakes situation, and it sounds like a process of discovery. Did you worry at all about whether things would go according to plan?
Oh, we always worried about would things go according to plan. We tried to think of everything, but we learned early on there was still a possibility of things happening that would surprise us. So by trying to think of everything, I think we prepared ourselves so that when the time came, we could handle the unexpected thing that might occur.
Don, I want to ask you about Apollo 14 briefly, because it was during that mission that the abort switch jammed and you had to write code on the fly in order to get the computer to ignore the switch and allow the module to land. What was that experience like? I have to imagine it was pretty intense.
Well, it was intense. It was I call it a three-hour crisis, as opposed to the previous mission, which was a three-day crisis on Apollo 13. It allowed just enough time for us, for my group in Cambridge, to solve the problem. If it had been on a faster time scale, we wouldn't have been able to be involved. But we had just enough time to do it. We also had the tools that we needed to do it.
Don, you were involved from Apollo 5 through Apollo 17. There were crises in Apollo 13 and 14. Did every Apollo mission have a crisis of some kind associated with it, or was that unusual?
I would say that all the early missions had something. Apollo 5 did have a problem, which I was close to. It was a case of code being written based on wrong information about the speed at which the descent engine would come up to thrust. And then on Apollo 11, the next mission where a great deal of my code was involved, of course, we had the alarms that occurred during the descent. On Apollo 12, we were struck by lightning during boost. But the more interesting thing about Apollo 12 was that mission, commanded by Pete Conrad, was given the job of making a pinpoint landing, in other words, a landing within walking distance of a pre-selected spot. Apollo 11 had landed about 4 miles downrange of where it was meant to land. Of course, that was a triumph. We had landed successfully on the moon, but you wanted every mission to do more than the previous one, and in order to get into interesting sites on the moon, sites of greater scientific interest, you needed to be able to land very precisely. And Apollo 12 verified that it was possible to do that by a combination of ground tracking that allowed us at the last minute to correct the navigation, also the skill of the pilot. I would say the pilot skill was important from then on, that at the point where the surface became visible to the astronauts, would they be able to orient themselves? Would they be able to see the pattern of craters that they were looking for? But you ask if there were crises on every mission, And I would actually say that from my point of view, once we got to Apollo 15, it went rather smoothly, at least so far as limb operations were concerned. Apollo 15, 16, and 17 were extremely successful missions without a great deal of stress along the way.
Don, I want to take you back to the actual moment when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin stepped on the moon. How did it feel to know that you helped them get there? How do you remember that moment?
Well, in the space business, you don't really celebrate until the guys are back in the ocean and safe. But there was a great deal of satisfaction that on our first try, we had been able to stick the landing.
Don, we're talking specifically about the Apollo 11 mission today, the first time man walked on the moon. 50 years later now, what's going through your mind about it?
That's a complicated question. If you would ask me in 1972, when the Apollo landings ended, what we would be doing in the next 10 or 20 years, I would have confidently said that we would be going back to the moon and probably getting ready to go to Mars. The fact that 50 years later we haven't done either of those things means that one looks back on those days in sort of a bittersweet fashion. You might almost say it makes you wonder if this was such an aberration, if humans were doing this so far ahead of when they naturally would have gotten to it, that it was really a freak of history, as it were, a perfect storm that occurred in that era, and that the conditions for that might never occur again. Depending on which way the world goes, will we in fact be interested in space exploration as the years go by? And the proof of the last 50 years, when with greater and greater capability, we've done less and less ambitious missions, suggests that that could be the case.
Don, 1968 was an incredibly tumultuous year in America. The Vietnam War, we were in the middle of the civil rights movement, multiple political assassinations, and the moon landing was something that seemed to unite not only us in the country, but people across the world. Do you think space exploration still has the power to unite people that way?
I think it potentially has that power. I think it's a proven avenue for international cooperation. Unknown to most people, perhaps, we're still very much cooperating with the Russians in space even now. We have Russian and American astronauts sharing the space station even as we speak. Because it's the planet Earth. It's not a particular nation. If you look at it from a cosmic perspective, the nations disappear. It's the fact that this race of beings on the planet Earth have had this aspiration and this ability and this curiosity, this scientific curiosity, to keep moving into new spaces to see what's there. I think that's what, from a cosmic perspective, this all means.
That's Don Iles, software engineer who wrote the code for the descent and landing programs for the lunar module. You can read more about his experiences in his book, Sunburst and Luminary, an Apollo memoir. So let's hear now from a current space explorer. Sunita Williams is a NASA astronaut. She has served as the commander of the International Space Station, has spent a total of 322 days in space, and is now working with NASA and Boeing on their new Starliner spacecraft. Back on Earth, she grew up in Needham, right here in Massachusetts. We spoke with Sunny Williams this morning on a less-than-stellar phone line from Texas, and she shared her first memory of the moon landing 50 years ago.
Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin walking on the moon when I was almost four in our house in Needham. We were down the basement where our black and white TV was, and our parents got us to come down there and watch it. I think it was pretty surreal as a little kid, like, oh, wow, that's pretty neat. I didn't realize we could do that. But it left a huge impression on me and my brother and sister. There was always that in our mind that, you know, people are doing amazing things. And, you know, if we contribute, we work hard, we could do it too.
And did they help inspire you to become an astronaut yourself?
Well, yes and no. I would say I thought, like, wow, those people are super smart and, I'll never have that right stuff. But, you know, it wasn't until later in my career when I was a helicopter pilot and I had the opportunity to come down to Johnson Space Center and meet some of the Apollo astronauts who had landed on the moon. And they said, you know, they needed to train on something like a helicopter to be able to do that. And I was like, wow, this is in my grasp. So it didn't, you know, it was always out there, but I just never felt it was possible until later in life when I had crossed a couple of those, you know, bridges and was able to actually have some of the skills that they had.
So you do have the right stuff, obviously. How does it feel to be modeling what the right stuff looks like on Earth and in space to young girls of color, women of color, children who might not have seen themselves as astronauts, and they see you and now they think they can?
You know, it's really humbling, honestly, to hear you say that. You know, I just feel like I've trekked along in my career and just trying to done the best that I could. And there are times that I thought, wow, you know, I wanted to be a jet pilot, but I became a helicopter pilot. Oh, you know, that's, you know, that wasn't my first choice. Or I wanted to go to one college and I didn't get into it. And, you know, then I went to the Naval Academy, which all of those things opened doors. And, you know, like, I think when I'm talking to young kids today, it's like those possibilities are out there. You just got to take the successes, take the failures, and you can do it. I see what I've done as attainable by anybody if you just put your mind to it.
And do you know some of those role models today? Do you know any of the astronauts from Apollo 11?
I met Neil Armstrong because I was born in Ohio. And so we had a group of Ohio astronauts all together a number of years ago. And I actually had the opportunity to meet Neil Armstrong, meet John Glenn. And so it was an amazing experience to talk to them because I felt like a little kid in a candy store, even though I was already about 40. And I was like, oh, my God, these are the guys. These are the people who paved the way. And they were so humble and so nice and so gracious and offered so much of their experience to all of us young people at the time that, you know, it's, you just want to pay back and do the same that they did.
You've got me feeling excited like I met them and I wasn't even there. All right, but you yourself have left the atmosphere. You have left this planet and been in space. And I want to read this out. You are the second on the all-time U.S. endurance list for females. And with 50 hours and 40 minutes, you are second on the list of total cumulative spacewalk time by a female astronaut. So I have to ask you, what is it like out there?
It's awesome. It's fun. It's interesting. It keeps your mind going to open up to new ideas. You know, flying around in space, and literally you flying around in the spacecraft, is hilarious. You know, it's
hilarious.
Like, you're like a little kid in a can because you're flying. You know, it's funny. After I was up there for a while, I said, I don't even remember what it's like to walk. I just enjoy flying. I enjoy cleaning the space station, which we always do on a Saturday, because you could fly and you could turn upside down. And it just tickles you. It just makes you makes you chuckle about, like, oh, this is so much easier than walking around and it's so much fun. And then, you know, like maybe you have a bad day or something, like something didn't go the way you wanted to, and you look out the window and you see our incredible planet below you, and you just have to stop and go, wow, we're pretty lucky to be living in that beautiful, beautiful planet. And I think it puts things in perspective. We're stressed out down here about traffic and lines at the, you know, at the coffee shop, when really we should just be enjoying, you know, the nature that we have all around us and the people, the wonderful people on our planet.
I know that the space program in part was a space race when we got to the moon, and it was competitive. And yet it seems like the great potential of space exploration is that it transcends boundaries and makes us one human community, one human family. Is your scientific community and the community of space exploration, do they transcend boundaries? And are you working with people from all over the world and all kinds of backgrounds?
You know, you hit the nail on the head. You know, I had the luxury of flying on a Soyuz spacecraft as well as the shuttle. And hopefully when we fly on one of the commercial flights, we're going to have some of our international partners join us. That's the way it should be. You know, people that we were not friends with at one point in time, we're hand in hand in the space program. You know, when we're in Russia training, you can't help but celebrate, you know, the great accomplishments of Yuri Gagarin and the Russian space program. When they're here in the United States with us, you know, they're all excited. Actually, I was back at Johnson Space Center yesterday and with a bunch of Russian cosmonauts taking a class together, and they're all excited about being here for the day that we had the moon landing. It's a joint appreciation of the scientific achievement of human beings. And really, you know, like when we leave our planet, we're leaving as a human species. We're not leaving really as entirely just an American or entirely just a Russian or a European. No, we represent humanity, and I think that's pretty special.
It is. It's inspiring. The Starliner program that you're working on now is a public-private partnership. What do you make of what the privatization or commercialization of space travel and space exploration?
I'm a huge proponent of it. I love it. I'm so glad to be part of it, and you know, hoping that this is the first step of, you know, a huge door being opened, the foundation for having more and more people being able to take, as I call it, a lap around our planet. If everybody got to take that view that I was mentioning earlier in our conversation, and you got to see the Earth from that perspective, I think we'd all have a little bit more tolerance for each other and appreciate each other a little bit more, and so put some of those differences behind us, because, you know, like I said, we all are from this one little planet. This is the only home we have. So I think commercialization of space is awesome because they've taken advantage of the technology advancements over the last two decades, three, four decades, and been able to put them into the spacecraft pretty easily because they've done it from the bottom up, from the ground up. And it's just going to open up more and more doors for more companies to be able to do that and more public to be able to take advantage of that ride to space.
So shifting gears a little, you're Sonny Williams, astronaut from Needham, Massachusetts. You are beloved here in the Commonwealth, and Needham is actually naming a school after you. What do you hope your legacy will inspire in the kids who are ultimately going to be educated there?
Wow. You know, that was the most humbling thing that's ever happened to me in my whole life is, you know, this elementary school. And I had a chance to take a look at it not too long ago. I was up there for another event, and I went over and got the tour. It is incredible. I think what that represents is, you know, there's huge possibilities for every single person, every single child out there. Whatever you want to do, you can do it. My dad came over to the United States from India with really nothing, and he established himself as a, you know, leading neuroscientist and professor at the medical schools in the Boston area. And I look at that and I go, wow, you know, he's amazing, and I hope other kids will see that, you know, all you got to do is do it. Go for it.
We mentioned earlier that you're working on the Starliner program, and NASA is actually planning to return to the moon by 2024. Can you tell us if that's on track, and what do you think is the goal of returning humans to the lunar surface?
Yeah, I believe it's on track. It's going to be difficult, but we have to, you know, allocate resources to be able to do it, and I think there's a drive, there's a desire to be able to do that. So why go back to the moon? Well, we have an International Space Station, and we're able to test a lot of systems, including space suits, propulsion systems, for being in space. But we want to continue and move on. And I think a natural stepping stone for us to move out of low Earth orbit and even out of our near solar system or our near orbits with the moon to go to Mars, we have to practice and we have to figure out how to do that to make sure those systems are capable and correct and do it well. And so really taking advantage of the resources there as a stepping stone for us to go further in our solar system, which I think is the ultimate goal. I think eventually people will be going to Mars, but we'd like to make sure all those systems work before we get there.
Will you have an opportunity to go, and would you want to go if you can?
Oh, heck yeah, I'd love to go to the moon. Can you imagine seeing our planet from that perspective, the moonrise, the classic photo? It would just be spectacular. I mean, wow, what a journey, what a ride. But I will also say we have some amazing astronauts in the office who have come after me and are doing wonderful things. And I just hope that I laid a little foundation for them to take the next step, and they'll do that next step for the next generation of astronauts. But if they said, hey, Sonny, you're the right person for it, go do it, you know I wouldn't say no. I'd be all over it.
I don't blame you. Sonny Williams, finally, for you, for NASA, for humanity, what is the legacy of Apollo 11?
Apollo 11 makes us believe anything is possible.
That was Sunita Williams. She's a NASA astronaut, has served as the commander of the International Space Station, spent a total of 322 days in space, and is now working with NASA and Boeing on their new Starliner spacecraft. You are listening to a special hour of Radio Boston, and I'm Tiziana Dearing.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717. 917-417.
We're looking back at the Apollo 11 moon landing 50 years later. And back with me here in the studio is Kelly Beatty, space reporter and senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly, thanks for sticking around.
My pleasure.
And joining us now is Marcia Bartuszak, a newly retired professor at MIT and the author of 7 books. So cool. On astrophysics and the history of astronomy. Marcia, welcome back to Radio Boston.
A delight to be here.
Marcia, what did you think listening to Sunny?
Oh, I really liked her strategy on what we need to do from here out. I totally agree that we need the moon as the launching pad for further explorations into the solar system, including Mars, including the other planets, the moons of the other planets where there might be life. I think that really is the best strategy because there are so many things that need to be understood before we venture further outward. Just think about a mission to Mars can take 6 to 8 months, depending on the positions of the planets. 6 to 8 months.
That's kind of a mind blower.
You know, when you're on the International Space Station, well, Earth is just down there. You can see it. The moon is just 3 days away. If anything goes wrong, there is a possibility for rescue. But you're going to have a group of people literally in a box of metal, isolated and alone, and they're going to be faced with cosmic radiation. They're going to be faced with muscle and bone loss. And as one NASA astronaut told me last year, his biggest fear was the psychology of you really have to understand and get a group of people that can actually live together in this small space for a year and a half.
Okay, first, you're giving me a panic attack. You're talking about that metal box and I'm freaking out. But before I want us to spend this time looking forward. But before we do that, I do want to ask you, Marcia, one other question. You also heard Sunny Williams reflect on that television in her basement when she watched the moon landing. Did you watch the moon landing and what do you remember?
I lived in front of the TV for 2 days. I was camped in my family's den. It was the summer before my junior year of college. I was an absolute space nut and I had my blanket. I had my pillows. I literally lived in the den for all that time. And, you know, I really loved hearing because I watched CBS, Walter Cronkite. It had to be Walter Cronkite. And what was missing from that audio is Wally Schirra really wiped away a tear and Walter Cronkite whipped off his glasses looking like he was about to cry before he said, oh, and he was rubbing his hands going, oh, boy. So people, go to the YouTube and watch that. It's quite fun to see it in the visual as well as the audio.
It really is kind of incredible, isn't it? Kelly, this theme keeps emerging today as we've been talking to people and as we've been doing our prep work for this. Everyone we talk to points out that it was a space race, but we leave the planet as a species, not as individuals, not as a country, but as a species. So why is this such a uniting force?
These days, it's a uniting force because space exploration is awfully expensive and no one nation.
That's such a practical answer to my question.
Well, it is a uniting force. It is the reason you mentioned earlier that we're working closely, Don Iles did, that we're working closely with the Russians and have been for some time. We need each other's help to build an international space station. We're going to need each other's help to build the next phase of getting back to the moon, which is to put a space station in orbit around the moon. It won't be just the United States. It might not be just the United States and Russia. It might be the U.S. and Russia and SpaceX. Who knows what the combination will be? But it is uniting in that it's this common goal that requires all of our technological expertise to succeed.
So I want to stay on this thought of technological expertise for a minute. We spoke with Alan Campbell. He is the Space Systems Program Manager at Draper. And we asked him about what we got from the Apollo missions that we still use today. Here's what he said.
The Apollo program was the first time people bragged about how small their computers were rather than how large they were. And as we think of that, has just progressed now that we have what they basically considered a supercomputer that we carry around in our pockets every day on our phones.
So, Marcia, this wasn't just a bunch of guys hitting golf balls in zero gravity, right? What else did we gain technologically? What's the lasting legacy there, and what are we using today?
Well, I'd like to refer to the historian Margaret O'Meara has just come up with this wonderful book called The Code, and she lays out a great case on NASA and the Apollo program really is one of the foundations of the entire digital revolution. In fact, when Fairchild Semiconductor was first established, it was able to stay in business because of its NASA contracts. So, and that those NASA contracts were for getting the integrated circuits for the computers they needed and making things smaller and smaller so they could go into the command and lunar modules. So we can look at Apollo as the digital revolution's source. I think that's, you know, it probably would have happened otherwise, but much later. So we got a jump start.
So, Kelly, you know, to the point of the digital revolution, two billionaires who have built their fortunes out of the digital revolution, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, are working on commercial space exploration now. Is the emergence of private space exploration projects a good thing, do you think?
Oh, absolutely.
And tell us why.
Because it lets NASA get back to doing what it's best at, which is innovation and exploration as opposed to building rockets. I mean, that was a key component of Apollo. Up until that point, NASA had been building its own rockets down in Huntsville and elsewhere, and it just got too big a project, so it had to rely on contractors. And here we are today, 50 years later, Elon Musk with SpaceX and Boeing with its Starliner are going to be the way that we get our crews to the space station beginning this year. Both of those programs are slated to launch their first crews to the space station. That frees up NASA. NASA doesn't have to worry about, inventing the tech. They just write the checks, and these commercial entities are more than happy, as they were in the Apollo era, to be part of it. Now, in the case of Musk, particularly, he has much bigger plans than just sending astronauts to and from the space station on a regular time schedule. He wants to go to Mars. He anticipates having his own SpaceX Mars mission, the first one launch in 2022. That's just 3 years from now. And the first crew go to Mars in 2024. How ambitious is that? That's a shorter time scale than the Apollo time scale. And again, it's all a commercial venture.
So, Marcia, Kelly referred to going back in 2024, and you did earlier, too. We actually talked to Sonny Williams about it. What more do we have to learn from being on the moon again? What are we seeking to learn the next time we set foot there?
Well, I'd like to see them continue the scientific research that came out of this. I mean, the biggest discovery, when they brought back the soil and rock samples back down to the Earth, we learned definitively that the moon was not made of green cheese.
Were we not sure about that before?
No, but seriously, it settled the argument on how did the moon even originate. That was a big controversy back in that day.
We really didn't know until we got
there. No, there were many competing theories, but the rocks showed that the most likely theory is that this big protoplanet during the early solar system slammed into the Earth and threw out an immense amount of material that started circulating around the Earth and then coalesced into the moon. So we are finding out about the very origins of the moon and our Earth-Moon system. So, on top of that, they set down various instruments such as reflectors, which allowed us to understand that the moon is slowly moving away from the Earth, an inch and a half each year. But there's so much to explore.
Again, freaking me out. The moon's moving away. Are we going to be okay?
I think
that's your physics lesson for next week. Okay, but I want to amplify something she said. Those Apollo 11 samples, at the time of the mission, we thought that the moon formed coal, just a collection of rocks that came together. And in those samples were little tiny chips that a team at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, today's Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, identified as being a special low-density silicate material that could only have come to be if the whole moon had been basically molten at some point and separated into layers with this sort of rock froth at the top. It was revolutionary. It is the biggest science result to come out of Apollo 11 and arguably out of the whole entire Apollo project.
What I would like to see is getting some astronomical observatories on the far side away from interference and think of what they could see into deep space back to the very origins of the Big Bang. I think that would be tremendous.
And you think we can learn that by landing on the moon again and continuing that exploration?
Yes, because we'll learn how to exist and live. We'll use the mineral resources. And think about it, you know, we have to think of future centuries to come. We're going to run out of resources on Earth. The moon offers an alternative. We can get the rare earth metals, the helium, all those materials that are needed for our highly technological society. And the moon is going to provide it.
Kelly, if people understood that better, would we have a stronger drive across the countries to return to the moon and for more space exploration, or do you think that drive is already there?
Well, I think it's partly there. I don't think technically it's there. I'm not sure the political will is there. One of the things that's changed in the last 50 years is our robotics have gotten so much better. We can send machines cheaper, with less risk to crews and more enduring than a crew could be. But the moon beckons, and it's like there's a new space race to the moon right now. And the driver is that we've discovered that there is water, ice, lying in the floors of craters near the moon's south pole. And so that water, in addition to doing all the things that water does, like we can drink it, you know, and so forth, can be split into hydrogen and oxygen and provide fuel. So there is an urgency to get back to the moon to see if we can exploit that water and exploit the lunar surface as a staging area, not so much scientifically, but as a staging area for future missions to go farther out, to learn to operate autonomously, to build things on their own when Earth is not in contact. I think those are all really good reasons to go back.
So, Marcia, I'm going to give you the last and the impossible word, which is in just a few words. What do you think ultimately is the legacy of landing on the moon?
Oh my gosh, you have given me such a big job here. I think reflecting on and echoing what Sonny says, that we have learned our capabilities and it gives us hope and an understanding of how much more we can do into the future.
That is Marcia Bartuszek, a newly retired professor at MIT and the author of 7 books on astrophysics and the history of astronomy. Marcia, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Kelly Beatty, space reporter and senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, thanks to you as well.
Always a pleasure.
That is our show today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.